Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is the official research podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Isabel Gardette, Director of Academics for the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who do research in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the research. These are people who represent the cutting edge in dispatch research, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Welcome to Dispatch in Depth. Today's guest grew up in the Denver area and spent 6.5 years working as an emergency dispatcher. While completing her undergraduate degree in psychology and working in public safety, she developed an interest in studying the mental health of first responders. She pursued her doctorate in psychology, where she studied the impact of secondary trauma on 911 dispatchers. She's now working on a program for PSAPs that would provide psychoeducation to help alleviate risk factors and suggest preventive strategies to help decrease traumatization and increase well-being for 911 dispatchers. Welcome, Dr. Stella Benami.
Thank you so much.
You have a very interesting background in that you worked in emergency dispatch and then began studying psychology and really brought the two things together. Could you just start out by telling us a little bit about yourself and your background? How did you get into public safety, and then how did you end up in your current position?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've always kind of had an interest in public safety. It was always kind of a career field that I was interested in pursuing. And as you mentioned, I got into public safety dispatch in 2006. And initially, law enforcement was kind of the field that I had planned to stay in, but while I was dispatching, I was concurrently completing my undergraduate degree in psychology, and, you know, so I kind of started to develop an interest in the mental health of first responders, and it ended up leading me down the path of pursuing a graduate degree in clinical psychology so that I can do a little bit of research and better focus on actually providing mental health treatment to first responders.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And in fact, one of the things that we've mentioned when we talked before was that you conducted a study in which you surveyed more than 1,500 participants nationwide about their experience working at PSAPs. So could you get us into that? Tell me a little bit more about what was your purpose in conducting that study. What were you hoping to find out?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that I've always been interested in ever since I started working in dispatch myself was the impact of that type of work on the actual dispatcher. So, you know, you have people sitting in a comm center taking calls, you know, for 10, 12 hours a day, sometimes 14 hours, taking back-to-back calls, many of them being emergency critical incidents, you know, domestic violence calls, deaths, child abuse, fatalities, things like that. And so as I was doing it myself, I, you know, kind of started to developed this theory that obviously there has to be some sort of impact from the chronic exposure to calls like this. And, you know, it piqued my interest in researching it more when I was in grad school. So kind of going off of my own experiences and also just, you know, having been around it for 6.5 years, it gave me a really good foundation to understand what factors to actually look into through my research. So that inspired my dissertation study, and I created a quantitative study where we surveyed call takers and dispatchers from all across the country, kind of looking at different factors that impact traumatic stress levels, burnout, compassion fatigue, and pretty much everything that surrounds those three constructs.
Now, before we get into the findings of that study, which are very interesting, a lot of people we work with who want to do research find themselves a little bit challenged or find some barriers in trying to get access to groups of people to study. So I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about how did you access all of these people? How did you manage to get your survey into so many different places?
Sure. When I was doing my research, my dissertation chair, Dr. Jared Chamberlain, he was incredibly instrumental in helping me kind of navigate that process of getting our survey out there, getting respondents, getting people to participate in the study. My primary method of communicating the purpose of the study was via internet. So I actually reached out to several individuals who have public forums for emergency dispatchers online and kind of communicated to them the purpose of our research, what we were looking to do, and asked them to, you know, share that we were doing a study, we were looking for participants, and that really helped kind of get us a lot of the participants.
Yeah, I love that. We talk a lot about collaborations and partnerships as the basis for effective research, and it sounds like you managed to reach out to people, maybe even people you didn't know, and really build those partnerships.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that it's one of those things, too, where word of mouth is very helpful. So, you know, having people that were willing to post, you know, the fact that we were doing the study and post that we were looking for participants on their pages, and then having other people see those posts and share them themselves, I think was really helpful, too, in just kind of increasing the participants and increasing the audience for it.
Well, then let's dig a little bit into the findings. What do you think are the main things that you found from this study? What were the things you really took away as actionable or the most important outcomes of the study?
Well, to start off, we had four basic research questions that we were kind of hoping to answer through our findings. And one of those was kind of just looking at the average levels of secondary trauma in this population. Also, you know, getting an understanding of what compassion fatigue looks like, what burnout looks like. So again, those three primary constructs. And if you'd like, I can absolutely expand on those and talk a little bit more about them.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, we were looking to see what are the prevalence rates of these three constructs. And also, do people's job experiences actually impact whether or not they're going to develop symptoms of secondary traumatic stress, compassion fatigue, and burnout, and what demographic factors might be at play. So is gender something that's important? Does age play a role? Mm-hmm. Does the job classification play a role? So whether somebody's a 911 operator or a dispatcher or cross-trained, you know, does that have any bearing on whether or not they're going to develop symptoms of secondary trauma?
I'm sorry, go ahead. Well, I was just going to say there's a lot there, and I think what you mentioned earlier, maybe we should, before we go on, kind of tease out those three ideas, because I think a lot of people think of trauma, burnout, compassion fatigue as at least very related, if not maybe the same thing. So can you just walk us through a little bit the differences between those three things?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's incredibly important to kind of differentiate the three, because there is kind of a lot of interchange in using those terms, but when you really kind of drill down to it, there are some functional differences. So compassion fatigue is a term that actually combines secondary traumatic stress and burnout. So when we talk about secondary traumatic stress, essentially we're talking about a phenomenon that's analogous to PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. So the symptoms would be very much the same. We're talking about somebody who's been exposed to a traumatic incident, and thereafter they might experience different physiological changes, so hyperreactivity, things like that, also nightmares, recurrent thoughts of the trauma, you know, just a lot of different psychological and physiological factors that cause a lot of distress and that directly relate to the trauma. So that would be the secondary traumatic stress piece. And then we have burnout, which refers to physiological and emotional burnout. So the way that we think about burnout with, you know, individuals kind of getting burned out with their jobs and not having the emotional investment anymore, feeling the physical effects of burnout, so feeling fatigued, feeling tired, having difficulties with attention and concentration that would preclude them from doing their job well. So when those two factors combine, the secondary traumatic stress and burnout, that's where we get compassion fatigue.
That's interesting. And the first time I ever heard the phrase compassion fatigue, it struck me as sort of a paradox, because we think of compassion as such a positive attribute that it almost seems like you couldn't possibly have too much of it. But then when you start to think about what dispatchers do, it sort of makes more sense. But can you talk a little bit about what does that mean to be fatigued by compassion?
Absolutely. So I think the you're right. It is an interesting paradox, because when we think of somebody who is a 911 call taker, we automatically assume that compassion is a part of that job, right? So when you're answering 911 calls or non-emergency calls on a daily basis, there's just kind of that expectation that there's compassion that goes into that work. You feel empathy, you feel for the people that are calling, that are asking for help. And when you start to kind of get bogged down with the process, when you start to get burned out, it's normal. It's fairly normal to develop some degree of fatigue with it, whether it's emotional, whether it's cognitive, but it's normal to kind of start to feel exhausted, with the job, with the different aspects of it, all of the stressors that go into it. And I think when it really becomes compassion fatigue is when people are actually have difficulty experiencing that compassion. So feeling that empathy towards their callers, feeling that empathy towards the individuals that they're working with, I think that's when it starts to kind of go into that compassion fatigue territory.
Yeah, we spoke with some other researchers a little while ago about the concept of emotional labor. And the same sort of concept came up, that emotional labor was cited by professionals as one of the best parts of their job, or the really engaging part of their job, but also as the worst part of their job. So it's that same sort of concept that you have something that's good, but too much of it makes you kind of incapable of managing anymore.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, kind of to piggyback off that, there's also the concept of compassion satisfaction, which we did look into also kind of as a secondary construct, but just to see what the relationship is between compassion satisfaction and different types of distress. So when we talk about compassion satisfaction, that's essentially the opposite of compassion fatigue. So that's the ability to feel positively about your work. It's when the work that you're doing actually elicits positive feelings, fulfillment, satisfaction, things like that. And so one of the things that we did look at was, what are the rates of compassion satisfaction in individuals, and how do those compare, and how might they impact the rates of secondary trauma, burnout, and compassion fatigue?
All right, well, let's just talk a little bit about that finding, about what you actually found in the study. So you looked at a number of different potential correlates or things that correspond with these different elements of burnout and compassion fatigue and so on. What did you find were the most predictive? What were the things that were most highly correlated with these various outcomes?
Sure. So one of the most interesting findings was that exposure to calls that involve death or serious injury are absolute predictors of secondary traumatic stress as well as compassion fatigue, as is a greater frequency of exposure to those calls. So the more calls that dispatchers handle that involve death or serious injury, the more likely they are to experience secondary traumatic stress or compassion fatigue. But one of the most interesting things that struck me was that the longer that people have been employed, the more likely it is that they would experience secondary traumatic stress and compassion fatigue. Now, to me, that was kind of surprising, because we had hypothesized the opposite. And I was somewhat expecting that for individuals who've been in the field for several years, there would be more of a buffer to experiencing some of these effects from taking these calls. And it turns out that it's actually quite the opposite, and there's still a cumulative aspect to it, to where, the frequency of exposure, but also this chronic exposure does increase the rates of secondary trauma, compassion fatigue, and burnout. And then a couple other things. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to follow up on that, because that's interesting. Your hypothesis was that they would maybe develop some methods for dealing with it, I don't know, processes or things that they could do in their own lives to sort of overcome these issues. But instead, you actually found that the cumulative effect kind of overcame that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I found that quite surprising, because even in my own experience, you know, working alongside dispatchers who had been in the field for many years, I kind of developed this idea that the individuals that were in the field for 10, 15, 20 years had a greater resiliency, because, you know, you would see a lot of people in the field for a year or two and then maybe kind of going in another direction. And so to me, it created this hypothesis that the people that are, that have been in this field for several years must have greater resiliency.
Oh, the idea that people who stay longer sort of self-selected into the profession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think it's possible, and this is just sort of a hypothesis, but do you think it's possible that the longer people are in the field, the better they are at masking those emotions or at appearing to not have those kinds of reactions, when in fact they might have them underneath and just not be showing it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that that is exactly what our findings suggest, because I think that on the surface level, it may appear as if people are a lot more resilient because they've had years and years of experience and they're simply not fazed by the work, when our research findings actually point to the fact that there are higher rates of distress. And, you know, that kind of leads us to think that likely what's happened is that individuals are developing good defense mechanisms to kind of mask that, just like you said. So it's something that may not be apparent or evident to a bystander, but absolutely the process is going on the inside.
Well, and that points to some of the importance of this work that you're doing, because it's possible that agencies could be looking at some of these longtime dispatchers and saying, well, they don't appear to be having any problems, whereas in fact it requires some of this more in-depth look to find that they are in fact having them.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that was one of the biggest purposes probably of this research, was to bring some of this to light and, you know, to kind of help get a program going to where we can help agencies and help management realize that this is in fact an issue. And even if it doesn't appear to be so on the surface, it is something that is very much going on. And it's important to learn how to look for signs of distress and to provide better support for the dispatchers.
So in addition to the amount of time on the job, what else did you find as predictors of this kind of outcome?
Sure. So classification as a cross-trained employee, so individuals who are cross-trained as 911 operators and dispatchers, also appear to have higher rates of distress. Another variable was a greater number of work hours. So people who are working overtime consistently, people who are working longer shifts, just generally putting in more hours over the work week, over a lengthy period of time, are much more likely to experience both secondary traumatic stress and compassion fatigue. A big one was also the perceived lack of support from management. So individuals who felt unsupported by their supervisors, by the managerial staff, who felt like they had pretty poor organizational support, were also a lot more likely to have higher rates of distress. So I think, again, that speaks to that need for communicating a lot of this information to organizations, to managerial staff, to kind of help open up that line of communication and provide better support. Let's see, another variable that correlated with higher rates of distress was insufficient staffing levels. So I know from my personal experience, as well as from my research, that is a really big one for dispatch centers nationwide. It's very hard to hire, train, and retain good talent. And it's kind of a chronic problem that dispatch centers seem to be understaffed, and there's always a plethora of overtime. And it does seem like those poor staffing levels are directly impacting the individuals who are working. So again, it's all likely kind of plays together, because when you have understaffed dispatch centers, there's a lot more overtime. So people are putting in a lot more hours. And again, that increases the degree of exposure to all of these traumatic calls. So we have all of these different variables kind of, you know, playing together and combining to create even higher rates of distress and even more risk.
that sounds like a good segue into the work that you're doing now, because one of the things that you have really done is to take this work and try to turn it into something positive for the center. So you said that their level of support had a big impact on their outcomes and their stress levels and so on. And I know that you're working with a group now that specifically focuses on this population. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what's important about the work that this group is doing?
Absolutely. So I am currently working for Brower Psychological, and we're a group practice in the Denver area that specializes in police and public safety psychology. So we provide mental health services to individuals that are specifically in public safety, police officers, dispatchers, firefighters, paramedics, anybody else who might fall under that umbrella. And so we're kind of in a really unique role to where we can really hone in on our knowledge of public safety and combine it with expertise in mental health to provide very targeted, very specific treatment to this population. One of the other things that we do is provide training to different departments across the metro area. So for me, something that I'm working on personally is creating a program to implement in different dispatch centers to kind of consult and help centers gain a better understanding of what the risk of dispatching looks like short-term and long-term, you know, what types of signs to look for in their dispatchers as, you know, potential signs of distress, and also, you know, how we can kind of help create resiliency and promote resiliency for the dispatchers.
And from your perspective, for those managers, what is the single most important thing, or the one or two most important things that they can do right away that can help them either identify these issues or that can help them support the mental health of their dispatchers?
You know, I think one of the biggest things is education. I think that, I mean, I certainly don't want to speak too broadly because I'm not familiar with, you know, every dispatch center nationwide. But in my experience, I think that providing more education about the potential risk of the job would be huge, because it would be a great way to kind of first give people a realistic understanding of what some of the side effects, some of the risks of dispatch work might be. I think for a lot of people who have never been around public safety, who don't really have the experience and come into this line of work, they may not have a very realistic understanding of what the impact of dispatching looks like, you know, 1 month down the line, 6 months down the line, a year or a couple years down the line. So I think just educating people about what recurrent exposures to traumatic calls, to traumatic incidents, what that looks like, what some of the side effects might be, teaching them about the signs, the symptoms of secondary traumatic stress, of burnout, of compassion fatigue, and also kind of helping separate out what you might call a normal reaction, more or less, versus what are some things to look out for as signs of serious distress where, you know, you might be better off seeking professional treatment. So I absolutely think education is a really big one, as well as monitoring. So when I say education, I think that it's incredibly important to also educate the supervisors and the management about some of these things and kind of helping them understand what to look for in their dispatchers and how they can kind of be that first point of contact for them when they do need that support. And, you know, even if they're not willing to reach out, maybe what are some behavioral changes that they might see? What are some things that they might notice in their dispatchers that might, you know, indicate that maybe it is time to get involved. Maybe it is time to have them at least talk to a peer support member or encourage that they seek mental health counseling. I absolutely think education would be first and foremost. And I would say second, probably to continue working on improving staffing levels and increasing rates of retention, because as I mentioned before, insufficient staffing seems to be directly impacting the rates of distress for our dispatchers. So, you know, kind of working with the HR departments and figuring out what are some things that maybe are contributing to poor retention, and helping kind of tease that out and seeing if anything can be changed structurally or from a training perspective to help retain people, help increase those staffing levels. I think that also directly impacts the overtime piece. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned before, greater overtime also is something that seems to be impacting the rates of burnout and secondary trauma. So if that overtime piece can be decreased, I think that would be huge. And obviously that directly links with the staffing levels. So if we can do something about the staffing levels, then the overtime piece would probably also get a lot better.
Yeah. And in terms of education, another thing you've mentioned is actually education on the other side, which is education for the psychology professionals. So you mentioned specifically that people who work in this field need to be able to go to professionals who know what the job is like and who have some idea of the realities of working in this kind of field. Can you talk a little bit about what you think is important for teaching the people who support emergency dispatchers?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an excellent point. I do think that there needs to be at least an overarching knowledge of what public safety work is like. I don't think that it's absolutely necessary, nor is it realistic to find mental health professionals who have personal firsthand experience in public safety, because, you know, that doesn't happen too often.
Right.
But I think that even having just a knowledge of what police culture is like and what public safety culture is like is incredibly important. The reason I say that is because historically, mental health treatment is something that's been really stigmatized in the field of public safety. And although it's getting a lot better and people are starting to seek treatment more and more frequently, there is still that stigma of, you know, not wanting to talk about it, not wanting to share that you're struggling. And likely that's something that deters a lot of people from actually seeking help and from even opening up to some of their coworkers and maybe talking about some of their experiences. So I think it's incredibly important for mental health professionals to understand that within that world, there's this expectation of strength and resiliency and oftentimes, you know, not really needing to seek mental health treatment because it's something that you can and should be able to manage yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so understanding that piece, I think, is really important. And also, you know, even when people do seek treatment, maybe understanding that it may be difficult for them to talk about it. It may be difficult to open up their, you know, it may take some time to build trust and to, you know, have a dispatcher or a police officer truly open up and, you know, share their affective experiences and share how they feel. Because again, there's, even if they are willing to seek treatment, there's often still this apprehension about truly talking about those feelings and truly admitting to the fact that they are in fact experiencing a lot of distress and that they're needing to get help for it.
Hmm. Yeah. I think that's very interesting that the education has to go in both directions, that it's important for emergency dispatchers to get education about the mental health effects of the job, but also that the people who provide the support, it should be targeted to the kinds of work that's being done and the effects that it might have.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So one last thing before we go, which is, after all this work you've done, both on the research side and in providing support for emergency dispatchers and being a dispatcher yourself, what do you think has the biggest impact on emergency dispatcher mental health?
You know, that's such a tough question to answer in terms of selecting one specific thing. I think that the job itself is so multifaceted. And clearly, even as our research shows, there are so many different factors that go into rates of distress, right? So there's so many different things that impact secondary trauma and burnout. In my opinion, and in my personal experience, I would say that a combination of organizational support and education would probably be the biggest thing the biggest takeaway. I think when we're talking about mental health, it is incredibly important to educate people so that they have a good understanding of what some of the risks might be of this type of work, as well as what types of things to be on the lookout for. You know, how do you know that you're starting to maybe experience some signs of distress? And also knowing that if and when that does happen, you will have the support from your management. You will mm-hmm. have somebody that you can talk to, that you can share your concerns with openly without worrying that you're going to be judged or that it's going to somehow negatively impact your job performance if you're unable to, you know, pick up overtime or if you need to take a day off or take a mental health day. So I think really just creating that foundation of support coupled with really good, solid education, I think would be immensely helpful with improving mental health overall for our dispatchers nationwide.
Well, thank you so very much for being with us today. We really appreciate it. This is a subject that is near and dear to all of our listeners, so we really appreciate it, and we look forward to hearing from you again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it as well.
Thanks for listening to Dispatch In Depth. Remember, it really helps us if you rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dispatch In Depth is hosted by me, Isabel Gardett. Our producer is Becca Barris. Reading Roberts is the technical director, and Scott Robinson is our executive producer.